Next is State versus Ernst Williams. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honor. Frank Chapin, Assistant Prosecutor, Essex County, on behalf of the state.
Good morning, Your Honor. Kayla Elizabeth Rowe, Deputy Attorney General, on behalf of the State Office.
Good morning, Your Honor. Brian Keith, Assistant Deputy Attorney General, on behalf of the State Office.
Good morning, counsel. Mr. DeCove, please go ahead.
I may reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal before
yes.
I begin. May it please the court. An accused absolutely has a right to present a defense, but that right is not absolute. It is properly constrained by the rules of evidence, which bar irrelevant evidence. The state's evidence in this case showed that defendant Lord Brian Civetti, an opioid addict who drove down with his friend Connor Gore from Connecticut to an apartment in Montclair to buy drugs, to rob him, and during that robbery, killed him. There was no question who did it. The only question was whether it was self-defense. To this end, the defendant testified that Brian brought the gun, tried to rob defendant, and during a struggle, Brian was shot and killed. The jury heard both sides and found the state's case true beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, what the jury did not hear, and why the appellate division reversed in this case, was that on at least one prior occasion, 7 months before the murder, Brian and Connor went to a public place, a mall in New York, and bought drugs without incident from a college friend. The defense conceded at a pretrial hearing that there was no evidence that these prior transactions were violent. There was no evidence Brian ever carried a gun during these transactions. There was no evidence defendant ever knew about these drug sales prior to the murder. Put simply, evidence of an opioid-addicted murder victim's prior nonviolent drug sales in a public place about which the defendant knew nothing has no relevance to whether the victim possessed a gun on the day he was killed or whether the defendant acted reasonably in using deadly force. It is simply beyond any tendency and reason to say that, one, Brian previously bought drugs in a safe public place, two, Brian wanted this sale to similarly occur in a safe public place, three, due to conditions on the sale set by the defendant after Brian left his home, the sale could not occur in a public place. Therefore, Brian must have had a gun on this occasion. Defendant is correct in his brief when he says the central question was who brought the gun to the drug transaction. The problem for him is that Brian's previous unarmed, nonviolent drug sales have nothing to do with that. As Weaver indicates, relevance is the fundamental principle which guides the admission of evidence, and the lack of relevance of the evidence in this case ends the analysis. Now, in the trial court, defendants sought to admit this evidence as character evidence and as prior bad act evidence, so I briefly want to touch on those two rules. Under Rule of Evidence 405, specific instances of conduct to prove a trait of character must be in the form of a criminal conviction, or that trait must be an essential element. Brian had no convictions for anything whatsoever, and a victim's violent character is not an essential element of self-defense, though there was no evidence Brian ever had a violent character. As for 404B, in self-defense cases, the rule does permit an accused to produce prior acts evidence that speak to the issue of defendant's reasonableness in using deadly force. But an accused must have actual knowledge of those prior incidents. And again, not only are the prior drug buys irrelevant to who brought the gun, as these past actions have nothing to do with guns, force, or violence of any kind, but defendant knew nothing about them at the time of the shooting, so they are simply irrelevant to whether he acted reasonably. But as I said at the beginning, this case starts and ends with relevance, and the evidence defendant sought to introduce in this case was not relevant to the questions before the jury. For those reasons, the trial court acted within its discretion, and we're asking this court to reverse the judgment of the appellate division and reinstate defendant's convictions.
Anything you'd like to add?
Not at all. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Rowe.
May it please the court. This appeal is about writing the course of this litigation and reminding the appellate division of the appropriate standard for relevance in the trial cases. Extraneous prior bad acts evidence about a murder victim cannot be brought into a case simply because it is somewhat supportive of a defendant's self-serving and chosen theory. Somewhat supportive is not the definition of relevance under our rules of evidence. And there are rules, and here the trial court's decision comported with those rules, while the appellate division's decision did not comport with the appropriate standard of review and did not comport with our standard of relevance as set forth by this court for Weaver for prior bad acts evidence. In fact, it's worth pointing out that the appellate division agreed that the excluded evidence did not prove that Brian necessarily had a weapon with him on the day of the murder. Defendant's self-serving theory never sets the standard for relevance, and appropriately, the amicus asks this court to remind the appellate division of the appropriate standard of relevance under Weaver.
Somewhat supportive could actually be higher than the standard of relevance in some settings. I mean, the relevance standard is, you would agree, a very low bar.
It's a low bar, but it's a bar nonetheless. It seems the analysis, though, in this case and in some of the other cases cited by this particular appellate panel, makes somewhat supportive a lower bar than relevant. Somewhat supportive seems to suggest that if the defendant chooses something to be true, or chooses that something might be relevant or necessary or interesting for his case, then he should be able to admit it.
Well, let's assume that we agree with, but I'm not suggesting that you do, but agree with the appellate division that the evidence was somewhat supportive of the self-defense justification. If that were true, wouldn't that meet the relevance bar? It doesn't have to be dispositive. It doesn't have to be the best evidence necessarily.
There's sort of two parts to my answer for that. First, in this case, the prior bad acts evidence was not supportive of the defendant's chosen conclusion because he wanted the jurors to divine from these prior peaceful.
Understood.
Businesses.
Sure. That's why I said I'm not asking you to agree with it. It was this, but that language does suggest some degree of probative value. If it's true, why wouldn't that meet relevance?
How it's being used in the opinion is really more, it seems to be hinging on the defendant's chosen theory rather than something that is relevant to issues brought up in the case. I think Genowitz is actually somewhat supportive of my point in this situation that there might be evidence that might support a defendant's chosen conclusion, but we still have to engage not only in the 401 but also in the 403 analysis.
Isn't the offer here strictly a character under 405?
Excuse me?
Isn't the offer here in this case, the offer by the defendant, strictly to character under 405?
It goes under 405, and initially he asked.
Because there's no 404B that applies. It would be 405.
It would be 405, yes.
And where's the opinion, and where's the reputation? Doesn't that end the argument?
It should end the argument that his reputation was. This wasn't.
There's no reputation in the prior acts, and there's certainly no opinion about character in the prior acts. Doesn't that end the inquiry right there?
It should, Your Honor.
Under Weaver, we recognize a reverse 404B when the defendant wants to use prior bad acts, and we said we wouldn't apply it rigidly because we're talking about a defendant's case. But in applying a relevant standard in that relaxed setting, do you feel that any particular prong of the 404B becomes more prominent in the analysis? For example, here, the prong that requires the prior incident to be similar in kind really seems to focus most intensely on the lack of relevance to those prior public sales and how defendant wants to use that information in his case, in this case. Do you agree with that?
If I'm understanding your question correctly, and I may not be, but if I'm understanding it correctly, the judge referring to the similar in kind and discussing that's still an important part. It's still an appropriate consideration of relevance. While I understand that Weaver is a more relaxed standard and Cofield is a more stringent standard when the state wants to use 404B evidence, it's still an appropriate consideration, just as the judge...
But the similar in kind has to be examined for relevance. It's not... The relevance really needs to focus on how closely that earlier incident is to provide relevant information for the defendant's use in the present trial. Do you agree?
It takes on a more weighted dimension under Cofield as opposed to Weaver, yes. But it's still appropriate to consider it under a Weaver the similarity under a Weaver analysis, because relevance still refers to things that may that add to a tendency for something to be true or false.
I'm suggesting it takes on perhaps greater importance in a reverse situation, because if it's not similar, how do we ever meet the relevant standard, even if it's a relaxed 404B analysis to begin with?
And here we certainly don't even come close, because those prior incidents were so much different from what the defendant negotiated while actually the victim and his friend were in transit from Ridgefield, Connecticut to Montclair.
Right. Isn't your position that because the evidence is not relevant, it could not be somewhat supportive? Somewhat supportive would suggest that the evidence is relevant. I take it that your position is that the evidence was not relevant and therefore was not supportive in any way of the defendant's case.
That's correct. To any extent, I address similar, somewhat supportive. It's to the extent that it seems that the appellate division compounded inferences upon inferences that if all of these previous transactions had gone so well, and had gone so uneventfully, defendant wanted the jury to surmise from that sort of negative that now the victim, who I should mention, it's important to note that as they were in transit, the conditions on the transaction continued to escalate from defendant's point of view. So defendant is essentially asking the jurors to surmise that because Brian got increasingly cagey as he approached Montclair, New Jersey, that somehow he got a gun, because in the previous transactions they had gone so well he didn't need a gun, but now since it was so different he would need one. So you're correct that not only are they so dissimilar as to not be relevant, but even the inferences upon inferences that defendant would have asked the jury to draw would have been impermissible under 403, or sort of the second Weaver consideration of prejudice outweighing the probative value.
Put another way, your quarrel is not so much with the use of the phrase somewhat supportive. It's because I think the appellate division panel understands Rule 401 on the standard. It's the application of the standard in this case.
That's correct. It's one thing to have a standard, it's one thing to have a relaxed standard, but it's quite another to diminish it to the point where there's no standard.
Other questions? Anything you'd like to add?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Keenan.
May it please the Court. State has framed the issue in this case as an attempt by the defense to introduce testimony regarding Brian's prior drug deals as evidence of his violent character in the context of Williams' assertion of the affirmative defense of self-defense. However, the defense has never sought to portray Brian as a violent person.
I'm sorry, would you keep your voice up a little bit?
Sure. The defense theory was that Brian armed himself with a handgun for self-protection when he learned that he was going to be buying a large quantity of drugs from a person he'd never met before in a private place that he'd never been. The testimony regarding the prior nonviolent drug transactions establishes his knowledge and experience regarding drug transactions generally and his state of mind in approaching the transaction with Mr. Williams. The standard for admitting this type of evidence is simple relevance and is governed by New Jersey Rules of Evidence 401 and 403. The fact that the prior transactions occurred in a public place with a friend that he knew from college made them relatively safe. Prior transactions provide the vital context for the safety measures he sought in arranging the transaction with Mr. Williams. Based on the safe conditions of the prior transactions, in fact, in the efforts to replicate those transactions were rebuffed, any reasonable person who is committed to proceeding with a drug transaction would have sought alternative means of self-protection. Consequently, the prior drug transaction evidence was relevant to the question of who brought the gun to the transaction and was admissible pursuant to Rule 401. As to evidence Rule 403, the evidence of past transactions presented no danger of undue prejudice because the fact that Brian had abused opioids in the past was already going to be admitted to the jury. In addition, unlike cases where the defense has sought to prove third-party guilt by establishing a similarity to other crimes that could not have been committed by a defendant. It is highly unlikely that the cross-examination of the two state witnesses in this case regarding the circumstances of the prior transactions would have confused the jury or caused undue delay. The exclusion of relevant testimony was not harmless. Williams testified at the trial and provided the only firsthand account of what occurred during the incident. The two witnesses who testified that Williams confessed to bringing the gun to the transaction with the intent to rob Brian both had reasons to lie, and Williams denied making those statements. The only evidence contradicting Williams' account were those alleged confessions. Therefore, the evidence was not overwhelming and the trial court error was not harmless. The question of who brought the gun to the transaction was central to Mr. Williams' defense. The prior drug transactions would have bolstered that testimony. The exclusion of that evidence deprived Mr. Williams of his opportunity to present complete defense and violated his rights to confrontation, due process, and a fair trial.
Are you done with your opening statement?
I am.
Logically, set aside the rules of admissibility for a second. Had the victim brought a gun to the prior incident, one might have argued his experience, his knowledge generally, his state of mind is he brings guns for self-protection, for safety purposes, to drug transactions, right? So logically, it could have furthered the argument you're attempting to make had he brought a gun to the prior incident, correct?
If he'd brought a gun to the prior incident, and you say that he's going to bring a gun to this incident, that would be a kind of a propensity argument.
I understand. That's why I'm asking you to set aside the rules for a moment. I just want to understand the logic and force of your argument that this is relevant, that it tends to prove the issue of importance here. If he'd brought the gun before, that intuitively would suggest that he brings guns to drug transactions. Propensity aside, that's a logical nexus between the evidence and what's sought to be proven, no?
That's true.
And you're also arguing, though, that the fact that he, I gather there's no evidence that he brought the gun to the prior transaction.
That's correct.
Right? So you're also arguing that not bringing a gun to the prior transaction tends to offer proof that he would have brought the gun in this instance. How can both be true?
We're talking about two different character traits here. If you're talking about somebody who routinely brings guns to transactions, that might speak to a violent character. If somebody who is routinely going to, you know, bring guns and come armed.
Or you might argue it tends to show that someone aware of drug deals takes security measures. The argument, it sounded like you were advancing, any reasonable person would have sought greater protection, as I think you said.
That's correct. But if you contrast the prior transactions and you look at the safety that was involved in those prior transactions, the fact that it was with somebody he knew in a public place, there's less of a need to bring a gun to that sort of transaction.
So isn't the core of your argument then the differences in the transaction, the fact that the defendant in this case didn't want to meet in a public place and that he was unknown, is a basis for arguing to the jury that he would have brought a gun to this?
That's correct.
Don't you have that from the texts?
I'm sorry?
Don't you have all of that from the texts? How does a prior incident in which no gun was involved help you?
It provides the context of, like, his prior dealings and the way what he experienced in those prior transactions, those prior transactions being safe. And then when you come to the situation, you see him try to replicate those same circumstances.
I don't see how this. I'm having difficulty seeing how this helps you. The prior instances would be modus operandi. He doesn't bring a gun. He's a purchaser. Mm-hmm. In this particular case, even during that trip from Ridgefield, Connecticut, all the way to Montclair, he's expecting, and this is according to your own client, this statement, the victim is expecting this drug transaction to occur in some public place, right to the very end, even in the car. He's saying, let's do it in the car. Let's do it in a grocery store. So I'm not following your argument that somehow the victim knew in advance that somehow this was going to be in some darkened hallway in some ramshackle building, and therefore I have to be armed, when none of the evidence even supports that, not even your own evidence.
Well, in this case, it's not mere speculation. We have Mr. Williams testified that Brian brought the guns to the transaction.
Well, that he testified to, and that gave you your basis for self-defense. But you're trying to argue that the fact that he was a known drug addict, okay, so we have to assume that he's purchasing drugs, that somehow that, the fact that he purchased drugs in the past means that he would come armed when he's coming to purchase drugs? Where is that coming from?
Well,
in terms of relevance.
I mean, it comes from the change in circumstances. He purchased drugs in the past in this very safe environment, and now he's coming to Montclair in a different state to meet somebody he'd never met before. Before he was dealing with this.
And when are you going to argue that somehow the light bulb went off in his head, okay, I need to get a gun now? When? When he got to Montclair and he's having this exchange with the defendant?
It could have happened in the basement when they were talking, in the fact that his normal connection wasn't available.
And how is it this entire speculation? It's like you're just like weaving this out of the air.
It's absolutely not speculation, because we have testimony on the stand by Mr. Williams stating that somebody else brought the gun. This is in support of that statement. It's not baseless speculation. Here we have the defendant testifying on the stand saying somebody else had the gun. And then we have this change in circumstances. I'd like it to, let's say you're going on a whitewater rafting trip. It's Friday, you're going on Saturday, and you call the operator of the whitewater rafting trip, and you say, what are the safety precautions you have here? The whitewater rafting guy says, you have a life preserver, and that's a safety precaution. Trust me, I know how this operates. This is my business. I do this all the time. You'll be safe, no problem. You ask about a helmet. Is the helmet included? No, we don't need helmets. You know, it's perfectly fine. That person, it's 6 o'clock, Friday. You know, you have other obligations. You might say, all right, I might go on that trip.
Like people are answering, no helmets necessary, no safety equipment necessary. We don't have that here. Basically, as I understand, you're saying if he had brought a gun to a drug transaction before, it would prove that he brought it now. And if he didn't bring one to a drug transaction before, it proves that he brought it now. So
that's basically what you're saying? If you had gone on,
because we don't have all that helmet and questions and all that stuff in here.
Okay, but if you'd gone on the trip before and you'd been provided a helmet and a life jacket, and you'd done this a couple times with an operator that you knew before, you'd be more likely in this instance with a new operator to say, no, I'm going to go out and I'm going to purchase a helmet before I go on this trip.
Why would you purchase a helmet before you went on a trip if you had provided one before?
If you were provided one and you're talking to the new person, he says, no, we don't provide any helmets.
Let me ask you something about character trait. You refer to this as a character trait. We know character trait is truthfulness or a tendency to lie, a tendency of violence, and of course there are many others. What I'm seeing here, I think, and tell me if I'm wrong, is the situation is evolving. The transaction he thinks, this is your theory, the transaction he thinks he's going to have with his college friend is not happening. Somebody else who he doesn't know. The situation evolves along the way when they're texting back and forth, and it's more and more alarming. And therefore, he, by the end of the trip at least, is in a state of alarm that you would say caused him to either bring a gun that he had in the car or go somehow and get one on the spot. Is that a character trait? That seems to me to be an argument that's different from a character trait, and that is that factually he did this, and this is why he did this.
To be clear, I'm not arguing that this is a character trait at all.
I'm
saying that given these circumstances, that any reasonable person, if this is your prior experience in drug deals, it occurs in a public place with some friend of yours on the football team that you know, you have a very reasonable sense of security in that environment, and you're put into this other situation with somebody you don't know. In the basement, when they're talking to this new person, they could have decided then, we'll bring this gun with us just in case.
So let's say you got the evidence in that you wanted. Okay. So you're able to ask a couple questions, that the victim went to the Paramus Mall and he purchased oxycodone on 2 occasions. Okay. How are you going to use that in summation now?
I would argue simply that in the past, The drug transactions occurred in this very safe environment, and now he's facing something that was much more dangerous. And therefore, it would make him more likely to bring a gun to that transaction.
Can I ask you a question about the self-defense argument as a whole and the strength of that argument so that we can assess the relevance of the utility of this proof if you were to get it in? Defendant testified and he said the victim brought the gun and that we wrestled, we struggled over the gun. There's no dispute, I take it, that the fatal gunshot was a shot to the back of the victim's head?
That's correct.
And how far away was the gun when it went off?
The forensics expert testified it was 18 to 24 inches, I believe, more than 18
to 24 inches. More than 18 to 24 inches.
Yeah.
And what path did the bullet travel?
So it traveled, it hit the rear of the head and traveled downwards.
So how is it consistent with a self-defense theory that a gun is fired more than 18 to 24 inches away with a downward angle? Downward trajectory for the bullet. Does the defendant explain this other than to say that they were wrestling over the gun at that point?
Yeah, I mean, they were wrestling over the gun. Both had hands on the gun. I believe that it's possible that Brian could have had his hands up and been struggling with Mr. Williams. There was nothing in the forensics testimony that ruled out defendant's version of the story. And also, as to, with regard to the distance, I mean, that's a question for the jury to determine whether they believed the expert's testimony or not.
You got your full self-defense. No one denied you that. The only question is whether or not the fact that the victim purchased oxycodone in the Paramus Mall was supportive of your self-defense. That's the issue.
That's correct. That is the issue, and it is a very low bar. It's simple relevance, and all we need to show here is that it was, as the appellate division said, somewhat supportive of the defense. And I argue that it is supportive of the defense in showing the contrast between the two transactions. The heightened danger in the second transaction led Brian to be more likely to bring a gun to that transaction, just more likely, slightly more likely. That's all we need here.
And our standard is abuse of discretion, correct?
The trial judge applied the wrong standard here, so I would argue that it's not due discretion in this instance.
Anything else you'd like to add?
Just to note, with regard to the harm, you know, the jury did deliberate here for 3 days, so this was not an open and shut case. The jury had a number of questions. They had 6 questions for the judge. They listened to the testimony or the statements of the witnesses, and it was not an open, shut, easy case.
We don't infer anything from the length of deliberations with jury, do we? I mean, there's some juries that are simply more have a slower methodology than others.
Yeah. That's possible.
They may have been deciding between first degree, between murder and aggravated manslaughter. That may have been the only dispute.
Your argument would be the same if they deliberated for 20 minutes, no?
It's true. I mean, we don't read into the jury's verdict, but I just wanted to note that they did deliberate for 3 full days. In addition, we did have a defendant that took the stand and presented his own version of events. So, and I would simply argue that this is somewhat supportive. It does move the bar slightly in favor of the defense's version of events, and therefore it was not irrelevant. And was not outweighed by any other considerations and should have been admitted.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. DeCote, did you want to offer rebuttal?
I'll waive rebuttal.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. Court's in recess.